BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Pia Sinha, who earlier this year became director of the Prison Reform Trust after almost a decade working as a prison governor. She was the first Asian woman to run a prison in England. The UK has the highest imprisonment rates in Western Europe. The prison population has risen by 80% in 30 years, and overcrowding, crumbling building stock and a mental health crisis place enormous pressures on the system. The woman who wants to solve some of these problems didn't follow a conventional route into prison governance and reform. She was studying for a degree in psychology and running a pub when a colleague suggested she could apply for a job in the prison service. After years working as a psychologist, she switched to become a governor. She hit the headlines in 2017 when she stepped in at HMP Liverpool, then labelled Britain's worst jail. She turned the place around and was rewarded with the St Martin's Award for Prison Governance. She says, "I think part of my job as a leader is to maintain optimism about change and hope and be the holder of hope." Pia Sinha, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Pia, I want to talk about your new role. Let's start there. You were appointed director of the Prison Reform Trust in April this year. We've just heard about a few of the many challenges that your sector is facing. How much hope do you have in that role?
It's a really good question. And I think that for people who've been in reform charities for a number of years, for decades, I think it's quite dispiriting. I've heard colleagues talk about how they've given it their life's work and yet the statistics are going in the opposite direction. But for me, having worked in the prison service for over 20 years and then coming to the reform charity, ironically, I come with optimism rather than pessimism. And I think that there's so many ways to crack the nut. And Prison Reform Trust, its aims are about not just reducing the prison population, although that is a fundamental aim that we should all be aspiring to. It's also about how we improve the lives of prisoners who are currently in the system.
I want to talk to you about some of those numbers, Pia. The prison population has increased by 80% over the past 30 years. According to government statistics, the current population in prison stands at almost 88,000. And there are concerns that there just won't be enough places to house them by March 2025. Are we simply sending too many people to prison?
I think someone had quoted this, so it's not my words, but Britain seems to have a love affair with sending people to prison.
It's the highest rates in Western Europe.
And we can't sentence our way out of this. And I think that's part of the problem. So the combination of the Sentencing Council giving longer and longer tariffs for certain offences and the fact that we're quick to send people for short-term sentences, particularly non-violent, low-risk offences, means that there's a bottleneck in the system. So we've not got enough people exiting the system and we've got too many people coming in. And that over a period of time is just completely swelling up the estate.
It's interesting hearing you talk, Pia, and you know, you said, talking about your new role at the Prison Reform Trust, you said that partly it's about trying to, you know, make life better for people in prison. And yes, I wonder what you would say to anyone hearing that for whom it jars,
yes,
because it might actually strike people as, why is that a laudable aim?
Yes. So you get so many people whose standard response is, A, if you didn't do the crime, don't do the time, or you should be able to kind of cope with that because, you know, you've brought this on yourself. And I can, to some extent, I can understand that people, especially people who've been victims of crime or know people who've been victims of crime, this is a very emotive subject. But ultimately, the argument stems to is that we want to create less victims as we go on. And if prison is not a place of rehabilitation, those individuals are going to come back out into society. And if they come out angrier and more frustrated and more traumatized and unrehabilitated, their chances are it will create more victims. So when I say that, you know, it's about improving conditions, it's about looking at what needs to happen in prison. What's the purpose of prison? And a fundamental purpose of prison is to rehabilitate people. And you can't rehabilitate people by locking them up for 23 hours a day. You can't rehabilitate people without compassion.
It's time for your first disc, Pia. What have you chosen?
My first one is a classic. It's Kathy's song by Simon and Garfunkel. And it's the song that when I listen to it, it literally takes me back to my childhood in India. I was born in North India and lived in Mumbai. And we, at one point, we shared our house. It was an extended family with my uncle and my grandparents. And it was a very musical family. He played the guitar, he played the flute. And this was one of the songs that we often used to just all go into a bit of a trance over. And it reminds me of watching my uncle play the guitar to this. And I can literally taste my grandma's food. And it was just a happy, carefree time.
I hear the drizzle of the rain like a memory it falls. Soft and warm, continuing, tapping on my roof and walls.
Simon and Garfunkel and Kathy's song. So let's go back to the beginning then, Pia. In 1972, you were born in Kanpur, Uttar Pradesh, northern India, and you were the youngest of two daughters to Tinu and Rita. What are your early childhood memories with your family?
We had the upstairs flat and it had a big veranda and we had a dog. I've got black and white pictures, so my memories are probably in black and white around that. But mostly spending time with my mum and my sister. My father was quite busy. He was at the peak of his career at that time, so he used to spend a lot of time being away. So it was the three of us in the house mostly. And it was an old-fashioned rickshaw driver. He hand-pulled the rickshaw and there was loads of us kids squashed in the back of the rickshaw and we used to get taken to sort of kindergarten. And I remember my mother used to sew and she would make me these pretty little dresses.
So you said your dad was quite busy with his career. He worked for a large insurance company. Your mum had a job in the civil service too later, I think. And it was your dad's job that took your family to Mumbai. So you were five then, I think. Were they quite ambitious people themselves, hardworking?
Very hardworking. My father was someone who very early on, I got the sense that he really enjoyed his work. He's 85 now and refuses to retire. So, you know, he's still kind of in the thick of it. And what I learned from watching him was that it was really important to enjoy work.
And what about school life? I mean, you went to a convent school. Were you quite a diligent pupil?
No, I was the opposite of diligent. So I had my older sister. She's nearly 4 years older than me. And we went to the same school and she was like the proper straight A student. So I was constantly compared to my sister saying, oh, your sister, you know, she wouldn't do that. And so, yeah, I had to live with that. I had to live under her shadow quite a bit when I was younger.
So did you develop a bit of a rebellious streak?
Yes. I just felt that that was my natural niche. I think I gravitated towards it. And so even in my very strict convent school, I was often on the naughty step. What that did was from a very early age, I became a very good observer of people. I think that was why I chose my career, why I chose to be a psychologist. I kind of was fascinated by people's stories right from an early age.
Well, before we hear more of yours, we've got to hear more of your music, Pia. So what's disc number two, please?
This is a Hindi song called Ek Ladki Ko Dekha, which means I saw this woman and this is what I thought. It's from a film called Love Story. Whenever this song comes on, no matter what kind of what's going on at home, everyone sort of gets up and dances. So we have a tradition in our family now where my sister hosts Christmas and I host New Year's. So New Year's Eve in my house. And it's almost always that the clocks will strike midnight. And, you know, we've after a few too many glasses of wine, I'll put the music on. And whenever this song comes on, everyone gets up and dances. And we're probably, you know, dancing incoherently and uncoordinatedly with our arms flailing about, but everyone does it, you know.
खाब जैसे उजली किरण जैसे वन में हिरन जैसे चांदनी रात जैसे
एक लड़की को देखा performed by Kumar Sanu.
So, Pia, when you were 14, your father got a promotion that took your family even further afield. He became chief executive of his company's London office and you guys moved here. How did you feel about leaving Mumbai?
I hated the idea of leaving. I was 14. I was in my final year of high school. I'd made all my friends, you know, I had a really fun life. And so the idea of leaving them all behind and coming to London was just, you know, kind of broke my heart a little bit.
So you and your sister adapted pretty quickly. You went to school in Wembley. You would have been 14, which is quite a tricky age.
Yes.
To make that leap. How quickly did you find your feet?
It's really hard to make brand new friends at 14 because you go whichever school you go to, whether it's a kind of rough school or a posh school or whatever, friendship groups have already formed at that age. And the only groups that accept you are the naughty crowd because they're all full of misfits and dysfunctional people. So, you know, I kind of gravitated towards them anyway because they were much more welcoming. And I guess, you know, I always had that naughty streak in me. So it felt much more like they were my kind of people. We were a bit naughty, but, you know, nothing that was, you know, scandalous. It was just that we bunked school and smoked and drank.
Your potential was spotted by one teacher, I think, who had a word with your dad about the circles that you were mixing in. What happened?
She spotted that, I did have some potential and I did have a brain. And she's quite honestly and clearly told my dad that he needed to take me out of the school. So I was taken out of that school and put into a rather posh girls' school in North London. You know, it was not even on the cards that you wouldn't go to uni. So you just did.
Pia, it's time for some more music. We'll have disc number three, if you wouldn't mind.
Disc number three is, when I listen to it, I'm back in Barham Park, which is a park in Sudbury, which is where my misfit friends and I spent our misspent youth. And every time this song comes on, if you remember the sort of video to it, it's just people sort of dancing and in the park. And it's Soul to Soul, Back to Life.
Soul to Soul and Back to Life. Pia Sinha, I have seen a couple of family photographs of you around the time of that song's release. And I have to say, you had the whole look going on. The buffalo look was in full effect.
Yes.
In those days.
Afraid so. I cringe when I see them now.
You rocked it. Pia, after studying for a degree in economics and psychology, you got married to your first husband when you were in your early 20s. There was just a small group of friends there and you didn't tell your parents until afterwards. Why?
Oh, gosh, probably one of the things that I regret a lot, not getting married, but not telling the parents. I think some of it was that I was a bit swept away by the whole romance of it all and doing it in this way. Yeah, we just thought it would be a laugh. I think nothing felt serious in my life at that time. And, you know, I just kind of went from crazy decisions to crazy decisions without really thinking about consequences too much. But yeah, it was very sad hearing my father's voice at the other end of the phone. And that's when it sunk in. I thought, oh, damn, I've got this wrong here. Mm. Because he sounded so sad that, you know, he wasn't there.
So the two of you at the time, you ran a pub in North London. I think you were known as the Governor's Misses.
Yes, Governor's Misses, yes.
And again, you know, it was attracting a clientele who were sometimes on the margins.
Yes, it's funny when you join the dots that way. It was a pub in Islington called the Penny Farthing. I think it's become a Georgian restaurant now. But it was the Penny Farthing, and it had a late license and it had a boarding house above. So it had about 18 rooms.
Oh, wow. So that's quite a lot to keep going.
Yeah, it was a lot to keep going. And I was, you know, it wasn't my profession. It was my ex-husband's profession. But it offered a house at the same time. And I was doing my master's at the time. I was also working in a market research company. I was doing voluntary work to clock up my counselling hours and working in the pub. And, you know, it was a full on week. But, you know, I was in my early 20s and it just felt like everything was fine.
It's time for your fourth music choice, Pia.
The song is Left Field and it's Melt. I saw them live in Brixton Academy when they were playing, and I remember
that was a legendary gig.
Awesome.
There are bootlegs of that floating around still to this day.
Yes, went to see it and just remember it being loud and just suffused with blue light, and wow, it would just blew my mind.
Left Field and Melt. So, Pia Sinha, there you were in North London working behind the bar, the governor's missus, and your first prison job wasn't actually too far away. You became a psychologist in Holloway Women's Prison. At the time, that was the largest women's prison in Europe. What were your first impressions when you walked in?
I think nothing prepares you for how you kind of react when you first walk into a prison. And first thing that happens is you go through an airlock and you get into the airlock and one side of the door closes while the other one's shut at the same time. And for a temporary moment, you're trapped inside it. Mm-hmm. And there's almost a sense of slight panic until the second door opens, and then you go in, and then you've got to go through this series of things where you've got to get your keys, and then you get a belt and you've got to attach it, and then you're going through gates. And it's really old fashioned, you know, it's not modern. So it's literally you're surrounded by metal and wire and clanging keys. And
those buildings are designed to have that psychological effect.
I think so. Yeah, they are. They are places of pain. And this is what I realized is, you know, after 24 years of being in prison service, putting your sort of mask on, you do have to do that. And Holloway at the time used to have, it's circular in the way that all the kind of wings are connected. And you had a subterranean level, which is sort of below ground and a bit dark. And that's where the psychiatric wing used to be. I mean, it was just a place of despair. And because I was working as a psychologist there and working in my crisis counselling service, most of my clients were in that wing.
And also, I know you've described kind of going home at the end of the day and trying to lock the bedroom
yes.
door.
Yeah. It's just the key and the key fob and the pouch just become part of your body in a way. And so, you know, going through doors, especially when I first started, I would try and lock doors behind me everywhere I went. And it just, you know, it just takes over your life a little bit.
And was work like that? Were you completely committed to it?
You know? Yeah. It gripped me, you know, it got under my skin. And I think people know very quickly whether prison is for you or not. It elicits really strong emotions in you, and sometimes not everyone's comfortable with that.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds actually you traumatized by it to some extent.
Yeah.
But there was something about it that you did react positively to. What was that? What did you feel?
People who work in prison somehow have this instinct that they either acquire or have it innately, that, you know, they run towards trouble rather than away from it in the way that other people might do. And I think that I found myself being one of those people.
Well, we'll find out where that took you next. But it's time for disc number 5, please, Pia. What are we going to hear?
This is now 2000s. It's that decade. And this is probably where my love affair with Liverpool started. And what I probably found in Liverpool, and I describe it as my spiritual home, something about the Scousers, the banter, all of it. So the song that kind of epitomises my time in Liverpool is a band called Love, and it's called And More Again.
And when you've given all you had, and everything still turns out bad, and all your secrets are your own, then you feel your heart beating from bum, bum, bum.
Love and More Again. After a while, you're fast-tracked onto the Senior Prison Manager programme aimed at training governors of the future. And your first posting was as a deputy governor at HMP Send in Surrey. Now, I imagine that's quite a different relationship with prisoners and staff compared to working as a psychologist. How did you adjust to that new role on the front line?
I think it really helped being a psychologist, and it was a women's prison, so I kind of knew my stuff with it. But what happens when you are an operational manager is that you are automatically given rank and authority. So people just listen to you just because of your rank rather than because of what you're saying. And I think it's really important when that's the case that you say the right stuff, because otherwise people will just do it, but they won't respect you.
You've talked a lot about the importance of authenticity in the role that you have, but also in prisons in general, because you have a very unusual population in terms of the staff and the prisoners, in that everybody is very adept at kind of spotting someone who's pretending to be something that they're not.
Yeah, 100%. Prisoners spend a lot of time watching people. They're excellent people watchers, and so are staff, you know. And so if you come in there as a leader and you're not your authentic self, they will sniff it out and you lose your credibility.
And of course, in terms of taking on a new role, in a way, there weren't any role models out there for you because you were the first, you know, you're the first Asian woman to become a prison governor in England, 2013, Thorncross Prison.
Yeah.
Is that first important to you?
Yeah, I wondered how I would be accepted in a sense. But I'd had quite a lot of experience of being a woman of colour in the prison system. And ironically, prisons are weirdly accepting of people because it's more about, are you in our gang or you're not? You know, and if you're in there and you're in the gang, you're in the gang. It doesn't matter what your colour is and what your sex is and what, you know, you're in it. You're in the trenches.
Well, we'll find out what happened next in a minute. First, though, disc number six, please, Pia. What have you gone for and why?
OK, so disc number six is a song called Black by Danger Mouse. And I think it was on the soundtrack of Breaking Bad, if people remember that very famous series that everyone was addicted to. But I guess it's about some difficult and dark times working in the prison service, some real highs and lows and some just really tough work. But there's something about this song that reminds me of that time of, you know, working both in Risley and in Liverpool. And it's a dark song, but it's also something quite powerful about it.
Danger Mouse and Daniela Lupi featuring Nora Jones and Black. So, Pia Sinha, one of your biggest professional accomplishments was turning round HMP Liverpool. Now, it had been described as Britain's worst jail. You started there as governor in November 2017. What did you find when you arrived?
I'd worked in Liverpool before, so I was deputy governor there 4 years before that. And so when I walked in, it shocked me just how much it had deteriorated, even in that short space of time. Mm. I knew the staff. They were pleased to see me. And so I kind of felt that in amongst all of the sort of devastation of it, there was still like a beating heart in Liverpool prison. But the infrastructure was crumbling. It was filthy. It was literally no window was left intact, rats and vermin everywhere. I mean, it was like deeply shocking.
So the building was under pressure. What state were the prisoners in?
It felt like they were just living like animals. And that sounds like a very dramatic thing to say, but you walked around and people were just, you know, vacant expressions on their faces and looking dirty, dishevelled, unshowered. It felt feral. This wasn't just happening at Liverpool. Liverpool happened to get caught with his pants down because that's when the inspector came in and saw it. But there were other jails within the country that were probably in exactly the same place.
Pia, as a psychologist, though, you have to say the psychology of a person who goes, yep, yeah, I'm going to go there and sort that out. Particularly interesting.
Well, I didn't go up there. Please, miss, can I do this? Can I fix it? I was persuaded, shall we say, strong-armed is probably the more appropriate word by the bosses to say that, you know, we want you to do this job for us.
What made you think you could do it?
I think the thing that did it for me was Liverpool, the staff at Liverpool. They wear their hearts on their sleeves. They're not the kind of staff that look down on prisoners. There isn't that kind of snobbery around prisoners, you know, and I kind of really liked that and I knew I could work with that.
Pia, it costs £46,000 a year to keep someone in prison. Yes. Is the service value for money?
No. I think that if you think about how much money is spent, I think it's something like it's in the billions, the industry, the whole system. And if you think about investing even a partial amount of that money in towards early interventions to preventing the poverty and trauma and mental health problems that get people drifting into the service in the first place, you will actually make a very strong economic argument for not imprisoning people.
One of the saddest statistics is the number of children in custody who've also been in care. So fewer than 1% of kids in England are in care, but almost half of children in secure training centres, I think it's 46%, and more than half in young offender institutions, about 62% there, have been in care. What would you suggest to reduce those figures?
I think the investment needs to be in those early interventions. I think, why does that cycle repeat itself? So a child will go into care because it has parents that are not able to care for them. And either that's because of mental health difficulties or extreme poverty or neglect or substance misuses. There's something that's causing that to happen. And the most simplest kind of the solution is that you invest that money on better schooling, on better welfare state and better ways of kind of looking after people who are struggling with those conditions. Because when you do that, you're kind of tackling the root of the problem rather than just the symptom of it.
Pia, it's time for some more music. Your seventh choice. What's next and why?
It's a really uplifting song that talks a little bit to the elation that we felt when Liverpool actually came through its inspection. We had a radio station and this person came to our radio station and we listened to the song and it hits all the right notes, which talks about the intensity of the experience. I think it was the highs and lows, but more than anything else, it was the intensity of that experience. And so this is Power of Love by Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
The
Power of Love, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Pia Sinha, successive governments have taken a tough on crime approach. They see it as a vote winner with the electorate. But having worked within the prison system for decades, what's the one thing that you would like people to understand about that approach?
I guess it's important to say that, you know, there are people who legitimately do need to be in prison, that they are dangerous and they have done terrible things. And for that, they need to spend their time in prison. And I'm not an abolitionist, but I do feel that we need to look seriously at what are the alternatives to custody for those who have committed non-violent crimes, who are low-risk individuals, who the reason why they've committed crime has been around poor mental health and substance misuse issues. In this country, we are almost criminalising poverty, we're criminalising trauma, we're criminalising mental health, because it's those individuals that drift into our prison system And it's for those individuals, the players, that we need to look at the underlying issues behind why they end up in prison rather than just the crime that they've committed.
Pia, it's almost time to cast you away to your desert island. Obviously, you'll know much more than most people do about the effect of isolation. How do you think you'll cope?
Oh, gosh, I think I'll struggle because I'm a very sort of people-oriented person. And all my life, I've kind of, my whole thing about how I am is about trying to form teams and family and all that kind of stuff. So I will struggle. But, you know, just like I've done with other things in my life, I'll put my big girl pants on and try and adapt, you know, metaphorically loosen the tie and kind of work out what I needed to do. And I'll probably manage to do it.
What about the practicalities? How handy are you?
I am rubbish.
Uh-oh.
So fishing and fruit picking. I mean, I'll have to find a way, right? Because, you know, hunger is a powerful motivator. More importantly, I think it's about how do you keep yourself mentally agile. And I think I've probably learned from the best places on how to survive some really tough situations.
What have you learned? Where does that resilience come from in people?
I think it comes from actually hope and believing that things can get better. So I suppose I might spend my time either working out a plan on how I would escape and get out or...
Oh, you're hatching an escape plan
I'm
now.
I'm already hatching an escape plan. But doing things that makes me feel hopeful. But also, I guess it's practicing mindfulness and practicing the art of acceptance, I guess, at some level. You know, you can't just keep, you know, banging your head against things that are not going to change, but looking for the opportunities or things that will. So, I'll probably have to have some strong words with myself.
Well, you can choose one more track before we cast you away, Pia Sinha, your last selection today. What's it going to be?
So the last selection is apt. It's Adele and Hometown. And it's one of those songs that no matter, you know, sometimes when I listen to it, I get transported to my life in India. Sometimes I listen to it and I'm in London. And it's just one of those songs that just reminds me of the buzz of life, no matter where you are. So the rest, I mean, I guess where you are is geography. It's who you carry with you along the way. And this song just makes me feel like that.
Around my hometown, Mae and Maury's a phrase. Around my hometown, ooh, the people I've made are the wonders of my world. Are the wonders of my world. Are the wonders of this world. Are the wonders now. I like it in the city.
Adele and Hometown. So, Pia Sinha, I'm going to send you away to the island. I'm giving you the Bhagavad Gita and the complete works of Shakespeare. You can take one other book. What would you like?
So my book is going to be A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mistry. He's an absolutely stunning author. I've read him about, God knows, 6-7 times and I could read him again and again. So I won't ever get bored of reading him. And it's about my favourite city, Bombay. So, it will keep me company.
What about a luxury item, something to make life more enjoyable?
So I kind of toyed with two and, you know, people who know me know that I always have my lipstick on me. You know, it's put your lipstick on and then face the world. But I realise that if I'm going to be cast away in an island, I won't need the lipstick. So I'll kind of put it aside. But what I will need is chili sauce. So everything of my food has to have a bit of spice in it. So if I'm eating raw fish, then it makes it so much more palatable with chili sauce. So I'm going to take some chili sauce and a never-ending bottle of chili sauce.
Absolutely. It's yours. And also, which one track of the 8 that you've shared with us today would you save from the waves if you had to?
Oh, gosh, it's just really, really hard. It's probably going to be Kathy's song. Because whenever that comes on, it just takes me back to just free, happy times. And it gives me hope. That's why.
Pia Sinha, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
Hello, It was lovely to chat to Pia, and I hope she's very happy on her island adding chilli sauce to her cooking attempts. There are more than 2,000 programmes in our archive, which you can listen to. You'll find people from many professions, including psychologist Daniel Kahneman and Uta Frith. You can also hear one of Pia's favourite musicians, Adele's Desert Island Discs too. You can find all of these programmes if you search through BBC Sounds or on our own Desert Island Discs website. The studio manager for today's programme was Bob Nettles, the assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Sarah Taylor. Join me next time when my castaway is NASA's head of science, Dr. Nikki Fox.